Good evening and welcome to the Cybersecurity Cryptocurrency Podcast. I'm your host, Eric English. Today is September 6th of 2018. We're on episode 28. Got some news-worthy topics today to talk about in both cybersecurity and cryptocurrency. So we're going to get to that here shortly. If you want to follow me on Twitter, I'm at eEnglish34 on Twitter, at eEnglish34. So before we get started, I want to give a quick update on my progress with these masternodes that I've been setting up, and essentially let everybody know, you know, how that's been going and where I'm at in the process. So I essentially have 5 of these up and running now, and they haven't paid me out yet, but they say they take about 3 to 5 days before you actually get a payout. But I do have 5 running, all of which are at AWS in their free Linux instances. It's a free Ubuntu Linux instance. The caveat with the free stuff is that it's low bandwidth consuming and all that good stuff, which I think it will be for the most part, but kind of yet to be seen. And I guess if you have multiple different currencies and multiple masternodes on one Linux box, that could create more network traffic. So AWS may eventually charge you a little bit, but that's kind of yet to be seen. I'm still kind of in the testing phase of all this stuff, but my first masternode has been running a little over 2 days now, so I'm looking to get a payout there. And I can officially confirm that it is real and it does work. But as of right now, I'm still a little skeptical, just kind of hoping that it actually does pay out like it says it will. But we'll see. Got a few more days here to find out. So we're going to jump over to crypto news, since I kind of kicked off with cryptocurrency topic. Masternodes. Really nothing other than the market sucks right now, but the only real newsworthy item was coming from Iran, of all things. Iran, in a nutshell, they are allowing crypto mining as a legitimate business, essentially. And because of that, the price of Bitcoin in that particular country, in Iran, actually spiked temporarily. So I thought that was rather interesting that Iran is going to allow this as a legitimate business now. They've, as everybody knows, the Middle East in general in the past has been very closed off, very restricted, don't let you do much. So this is good to see that more countries are accepting of this and recognizing that blockchain technology and cryptocurrency isn't so bad, and it's actually good for a lot of countries as well. Obviously, it takes up a lot of power, but it's still good in general. So I thought that was kind of interesting that Iran's doing that stuff. Hopefully, more countries will kind of follow suit. But the market today has been pretty crappy. As of right now, Bitcoin's trading at 6,400. Bitcoin Cash is at 508. Ethereum, for some reason, 225 for Ethereum, which is god-awfully low. Ethereum Classic's trading at $11.78, and Litecoin is at $56.30. Overall, really, really terrible. All because of that, I think it was more than $12 billion now that was taken out of the market. But as we know, when, you know, big investors take big chunks like that out of the market, it automatically starts triggering people's sell-off. So essentially in all the crypto exchanges, you can set a trigger or basically an auto sell when the price gets to a certain point to cut your losses or to gain as much profit as you can. So when Bitcoin drops to X amount sell everything that I've got kind of thing. So when somebody takes $12 billion out of the market and crypto drops, that's going to trigger a bunch of these sell-offs that are automatically happening that people have programmed into their exchange platform that they're using. So that's why after the initial $12 billion, you saw the market dip even further. That's why Bitcoin's now trading around $6,400. The initial $12 billion got Bitcoin down to, I believe it was like 6,800 at its low point. And then as all those sell-offs started happening, we saw the market tank even further, and Bitcoin's trading at 6,400 now. So definitely sad to see that kind of stuff happening to us, but keeping an open mind here and trying to stay positive about it. So we'll see how it rebounds here in the near future. But that's really all I've got for crypto news. I'm going to go ahead and jump over to cybersecurity news. There was quite a few things to touch on for cybersecurity today. The Apache Struts 2 vulnerability that came out, I guess it was last week. There are active exploits happening right now. They're doing crypto mining malware injections into these servers that are running Apache Struts. So if you haven't already patched it, for goodness sakes, get out there and patch. If you're running Apache Struts, hurry up and patch, because they are exploiting this actively and they're going to kill performance on your web server potentially. So get out there and patch that thing as quick as you can. I do still think it's interesting that we're using crypto mining malware. And like I said yesterday, I think the trend might move to, you know, creating these master nodes moving forward, master node malware. You know, especially if these hackers are good enough to take over a router, you could then open the right ports on the firewall, and from there all you have to do is install the master node software on, you can even do it on the router potentially if it's got a back-end Linux system that you can get to. So that'd be interesting to see if that comes to fruition. So we shall see. But it just kind of shows also why I do a podcast on cybersecurity and cryptocurrency, because they cross over so many times. I mean, this is one example with crypto mining malware, but there's so much crossover that happens between the two. That's why I created this podcast to begin with. Other news. Everybody remembers the big Sony hack that happened, and the hackers were going to release a movie way early and all that fun stuff, and they got, you know, several hundred gigs worth of data from Sony. Well, they finally tracked down the person that did it. They're in Korea, of course. North Korea, to be exact. And this person was also responsible for WannaCry outbreaks as well. So they finally caught this guy, and they're going to start prosecuting him. They haven't said how much he's going to, how long he's going to spend in jail, but I'm assuming it's going to be quite a bit. But everybody's blaming Korea, North Korea, and they're saying, you know, why are you allowing this? And they're saying it was government-sponsored hacking and all kinds of other stuff. A lot of it's just rampant speculation, but certainly interesting news to read about. And I'll keep watching this story to see how much jail time this guy gets and see if North Korea admits to funding any of this guy's work. Some other interesting news. I saw this in scmagazine.com. There are quite a few cyber gangs out there, as we all know, and the FBI here in the last couple of weeks warned about a pending ATM withdrawal attack that was going to start happening. And here we go. Here's some news about a hacker group. The cyber gang, let's see if they got the name of the cyber gang. They do not, but they got $800,000 out of various ATMs all around the country, I believe. FBI warned of it, and they still were able to pull this off. Now, why? I guess my question is, why weren't, you know, the banks taking proactive action and patching their ATMs or whatever they need to do to prevent this kind of stuff? They just let it happen? Now, I understand that, you know, bankers may not have the resources to or the know-how to go out there and patch whatever flaw it is. And maybe they're exploiting a zero-day flaw on the ATMs that nobody's found yet either. There's a lot of what-ifs. But, you know, it's certainly interesting to think about, you know, why didn't we get out there and actively do something? Or, you know, on the back end of the ATM system, as long as you could, you know, potentially create this kind of alert or something that goes off when somebody withdraws a certain amount of money or whatever it is, if you could do that and trigger some sort of an alarm that goes off, that would be ideal. But, you know, if you could also trigger something where it would stop spitting out all this money if it was over a certain amount, you know, that would be a good mitigating control to put in place. And maybe this flaw that they're exploiting, you know, would completely circumvent all of that. You just never know. But I do think it's interesting that they got away with $800K. It's quite a bit of money. And who's to say they're not going to just do it again? Now, I've worked with banks quite a bit in my IT career, and the back-end system on a lot of these ATMs is Windows. And a lot of them, up until, you know, a couple years ago, were still running Windows XP embedded. You can imagine my surprise when I first found out that these ATMs were just running a version of Windows, some of which were not just XP embedded, they were just Windows XP. And the vast majority of them were way behind on patches and updates. And it was scary to think that we're running our ATMs with this kind of software that's running on an outdated operating system that's, you know, unpatched and then no longer being patched. So they upgraded a bunch of them to Windows 7. And, you know, Windows 7 is going to be unsupported here pretty soon, too. The biggest issue that I found when I was the IT guy for these banks is they wouldn't allow you to patch the ATMs because they were afraid it was going to break the ATM software. The software was so clunky that if you patch the operating system, it would break their software. Now, I scratch my head and go, you know, this is 2018, right? I mean, we're not living in, you know, 1970 where everything's super fragile. I mean, we should be able to write some robust code that can work regardless if the operating system is being patched or not. Now, I understand there's, you know, there's a .NET framework update that breaks something. You know, I get it. It's going to happen. But general security patches, that shouldn't matter. Or at least you would think it wouldn't matter. But apparently it does, and it breaks the ATM software and renders their ATMs useless. So, in the vast majority of banks, especially community banks that I would go to and do tech work for, they would never let me patch the ATM. It was not part of a regular patch cycle. So, I'm not surprised that these guys got away with, you know, $800K and they're hacking these ATMs. I'm not surprised at all. We're running extremely old operating systems and very clunky software that's probably buggy as hell. Now, obviously, the big banks like Chase and Bank of America and Citi and all those guys, they have their own ATMs and their own ATM software. But for all the small community banks, they have to rely on a vendor to provide that ATM and the ATM software that runs everything. Another thing that I also found really scary at the time with the ATMs, and there's actually I think it was a FBI agent that did a speech about ATMs and all the vulnerabilities with ATMs, physical and virtual vulnerabilities, physical and logical, I should say. The ATMs were locked However, to get to the computer in the ATM, it was locked with one of those generic round keys with a little knob on the on one of the edges of the round key. That's not exactly secure. You can buy those generic round keys pretty much anywhere, and you could pick that lock in probably half a second. I mean, at least get a key lock on there. I mean, is that too much to ask? But at the time when I was doing this, it was these round circular locks, and that would get you into where the computer was sitting. It would also get you into, oftentimes they had their own circuit in there, their own router in there. And you could access all of those things just with this little round key. I was just shocked. But as the tech guy, I was just there to fix whatever was wrong and troubleshoot whatever network issue it was. But in the back of my head, I was thinking, good God, this is an ATM that spits out money. We're locking it with this generic key. And the safe underneath is tied to this computer that somebody could access extremely easily. Now, of course, banks have cameras everywhere. They're going to have cameras on the ATMs. So that's, you know, I guess that's a mitigating tactic that you can use if you're a bank. But these guys, all they have to do is wear masks and sunglasses and gloves and everything, and, you know, walk up to the ATM and don't drive a car up to it. And even if they are on camera, they could care less. All they're going to know is their height. And that's it. And these guys could get in there, plug in a malicious USB, hack into the system right there if they wanted to. Sometimes there's even a keyboard and mouse inside that ATM. And I live in Texas, so you can imagine the heat in the summertime. These ATMs were outside oftentimes, and, you know, it's 110 degrees. You open up that ATM case, and good gosh, it was so hot, so freaking hot, and the computer in there, the fans are just running full blast. It's no wonder the ATMs crash so much, too. You know, you're running it out there, and there's no air circulation in that ATM, and it's just hotter than Hades outside, especially in places like Texas, but certainly scary to think about all that. I'll see if I can dig up that article or that seminar. I'm not sure which one it was. It may have been something that I went to, a seminar or something, a banker's seminar or conference. But there was a guy that was a security guy that was talking about all these vulnerabilities with ATMs. And he's spot on. I'm not surprised these guys got away with it. They got away with 800K. Not surprised one bit. And I'm sure it'll happen again. I also find funny, too, when you go into a gas station, for example, and they've got an ATM there. Oftentimes, they'll have it hooked into their network. And it is so easy to see where the cable's running. You could even put a tap on the cable if you wanted to. Unplug it and put a tap on it and plug it right back in. Nobody would even notice that tap is there. I mean, you could do all kinds of nasty stuff. Because oftentimes they just throw it in a corner and they don't think about hiding all the wires and making sure that it's secure. They just, we need an ATM. Just throw it over there. I don't care what you do with it. Just make sure it's spitting out money and charging a ridiculous fee to take my money out. So there's all different kinds of ways you can hack ATMs. And I guess these have been happening. Individual hacks have been happening quite a bit on these ATMs, but I'm not surprised there was such a large-scale attack. Not surprised at all. But anyway, moving on to other cybersecurity news. By the way, I'm going to post all these articles in the show notes so you can all check them out when you want to, if you want to. The next one I wanted to talk about briefly was, this is more privacy related than, you know, super cybersecurity stuff, but the company 23andMe, they do those DNA tests to tell you, you know, who you're related to and your origin and, you know, whether or not you're susceptible to various forms of cancer or whatever it is that they provide you. I did one for Ancestry DNA. But there's always these privacy concerns that come up. You're giving your DNA to a company, right? And what the hell are they doing with that DNA information? Well, 23andMe, one of their spokespeople, actually came out and said that anybody that's a super privacy concerned person, that they needed to opt out of this deal that they have with GlaxoSmithKline. Now, apparently they were sharing some of this DNA data with GlaxoSmithKline. I haven't read all the nitty-gritty details of it, but they're sharing your DNA data with an outside company, but apparently you can opt out of these things. And it was just funny that one of their spokespeople came out and said to opt out of this if you're concerned about privacy. Really, really makes you stop and think. Now I question whether or not I should have done that one with Ancestry or not. Really makes me reconsider doing it. You know, at the time it seemed like a fun little thing, and hey, let's see who else I'm related to and see where I come from. And apparently I'm mostly Scottish, of all things. Had no idea. My parents thought we were German, but you learn a lot when you go through those things, and that was kind of the whole reason that we did it, is to see, you know, hey, do we have any long-lost relatives, and you know, let's check out our family tree. Caveat there is other people have to have done the DNA test that are also in your family and things like that. So there are some caveats with it, but it was certainly cool to see all of that information that they were able to show us just from our DNA and show us where we originated and all that cool stuff. So I thought that was really cool. But then I questioned, you know, seeing this, that they're sharing, this is 23andMe, it's a different company, but, you know, Ancestry could be doing the very same thing and sharing that DNA information with somebody. To me, this is, I guess it's more scary than anything, the potential that somebody could do something extremely dangerous with your DNA. Now, we're probably a century away from really being able to do a whole lot with DNA, you know, especially like recreating a dinosaur, for example, like they did in Jurassic Park, you know, just with some leftover DNA, they were able to, you know, respawn a dinosaur. You know, what if they could do that with humans? With your exact DNA, they're going to take your exact DNA and make a complete perfect replica of you. Now that would be scary. And who knows if these companies are collecting this to eventually one day be able to create clones of ourselves. That's freaky to think about. Obviously, I'm going way off the deep end here, but that's kind of where my mind wanders to when I stopped and think, you know, what are they going to do with all this DNA information? And what could somebody do maliciously with it? So if they're going to create your clone, I mean, I could see where that would be, you know, potentially be dangerous. You could get accused for things that you may or may not have actually done. Maybe your clone did it, but they've got the same DNA as you do, the exact same DNA, so something gets pinned on you rather than your clone. I mean, there's all kinds of weird stuff that people could do with that information. I hope that I'm completely wrong and that we use the DNA information to, you know, further our research in medicine and be able to actually change people's DNA for good, for the purposes of healing and preventing diseases from ever happening to begin with. But, you know, we're a long way from doing that to, we're certainly getting there, but still a very, very, very long way away from actually being able to change DNA, you know, extremely effectively, at least. They are able to do it for specific things right now. But I'm talking about preventing cancer completely just by changing DNA, for example. So that's the kind of stuff that I hope they do with it. But even the spokesperson for 23andMe said to opt out. So if you've done a DNA test with 23andMe, or even Ancestry, or whoever, make sure you go in there and check their privacy settings and make sure that they're not going to share your information, share your DNA with some outside party that's maybe going to share it again with somebody else. That's where it gets scary. You know, the DNA information gets shared with one person, one company. And then where does the sharing of that information stop? Because each company is going to have its own privacy policies. So, you know, the 23andMe folks share it with GlaxoSmithKline, who then shares it with, you know, 15 other companies. I mean, that you can go down the rabbit hole and see where this could be potentially really, really scary and really dangerous. You know, you also read about countries like, I believe it's China, that's going to start rating their citizens with a numeric score. you know, you think about that kind of stuff, and then you think about this DNA data, and, you know, you could really do some freaky stuff, but hopefully I'm uber paranoid and none of this stuff ever happens. And they use it for good purposes, but you just never know. But that's all I really had for newsworthy items. It's still kind of been a slow news week, I guess because of the holiday on Monday. But we'll continue doing the podcast, and I'll see if I can drum up some other interesting articles that we can chat about on here. And I'll update everybody on my Masternode progress as I continue down that path. I am still mining. I did spin up my miners again. I did shut them off for a while when the market tanked. I'm very, very close to shutting it off again because the market's down so low, but, you know, I'm probably just going to let it run and just save whatever I'm getting from it and hope that it eventually comes back to where it was last year. But we'll see. Hopefully that market goes back up to where it was. We hit a monthly high of 7,400, and now we're back down to 6,400. But hopefully we get right back up there later on this month. So anyway, that's all I got for today. Thanks, everybody, for listening, and thanks for the feedback that I'm getting on Twitter and everywhere else. So I appreciate everybody listening. If you have any ideas for stuff that you want me to ramble on about on the show, send them to me on Twitter. Hit me up. If you find interesting articles that you want my opinions on or anything like that, certainly hit me up. Let me know. Send it to me on Twitter. I'm at eEnglish34 on Twitter. Hit me up. Send me all those ideas and stuff. And I can certainly talk about it here on the show. So, like I said, that's all I got for today. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk again tomorrow.